A carnival works because people pay to feel amazed and scared, says one of the characters in Catherine Dunn's new novel, Geek Love. Some novelists complain about a lack of attention from their publishers, but Catherine Dunn has no complaints in that area. Geek Love was the first book purchased by Sonny Mehta after he became president and editor-in-chief of Knopf, and Knopf has invested considerable money in promoting this new book. Geek Love is the story of a carnival couple, Al and Lil Banuski, who decide to breed their own freak show by experimenting with insecticides, illicit and prescription drugs, and radioisotopes during each of Lil's pregnancies. Lil says, "What greater gift can you give your children than an inherent ability to earn a living by just being themselves?" The story is narrated by one of Al and Lil's children, Olympia.
"My father spared no expense in these experiments. My mother had been liberally dosed with cocaine, amphetamines, and arsenic during her ovulation and throughout her pregnancy with me. It was a disappointment when I emerged with such commonplace deformities. My albinism is the regular pink-eyed variety, and my hump, though pronounced, is not remarkable in size or shape as humps go. My situation was far too humdrum to be marketable on the same scale as my brothers and sisters. Still, my parents noted that I had a strong voice and decided I might be an appropriate shill and talker for the business. A bald albino hunchback seemed the right enticement toward the esoteric talents of the rest of the family. The dwarfism, which was very apparent by my third birthday, came as a pleasant surprise to the patient pair and increased my value."
I'm going to ask you to describe the Banuski Museum of Nature's Innovative Art.
This is the family shrine, which the Banuskis refer to as the chute. And over the years, it becomes a kind of museum of the bizarre, in which they have stuffed featherless chickens, two-headed cats, five-legged calves, and so on. But the core of the chute is what was also the purpose for designing the chute in the first place, and that is the 20-gallon jars in which are stored permanently the unsuccessful experiments of Al and Lil, who are the children who they had modified through these chemical techniques, who did not survive.
What got you thinking about freaks?
Well, I think that like many, and perhaps most, young people, when I was young, I felt myself to be very much an outsider. And as I go through life, I see that a lot of people have that feeling of being always outside, never quite belonging. How many of us have come through life totally disaffected toward our own physiques? You know, none of us look like the current fashion model of the time. Even fashion models themselves are in a kind of constant struggle with their own bodies to attain some kind of ideal which exists perhaps only in their mind or maybe only in a Pepsi-Cola ad. But it's that kind of constant feeling of we are all freaks inside. There's always that sense of isolation and of not quite fitting in, whether it's physical, mental, or through our personalities.
Well, you're talking about freak as metaphor. I'm wondering if your book, you also did some research on people who were born deformed and ended up being the exhibits in freak shows.
I did do some research on that. And one of the basic concepts for me in this book is that my characters are not disabled. My characters are not handicapped. They are uniquely gifted. And the fact that they are uniquely gifted is primarily based on how they think of themselves. Most people in our society would look at them and think, oh, these poor people, they're disfigured, they're deformed, they're handicapped. Well, they're not. They're extremely hardworking, talented, intelligent people who make an extremely good living for themselves. And, you know, there may be moral questions about what they're doing and why they're doing it in many cases. But that has nothing to do with their functionality as people.
Now, you had a strange job as the author of this book because you had to design all the deformities that you gave to your characters. I think of you as having this deformity notebook with all these characters with different deformities and taking one out and thinking, no, that won't work, and substituting another.
Well, actually, I didn't need to do that. They kind of sprang full-blown from Zeus's ear, if you know what I mean. They each were created more or less in response to the necessity of the story.
Give us an example of how you designed a character for the role they were going to play in the novel.
Well, young Fortunato, for example, known throughout the book as the Chick, is the only child who is born to the Banuskis, apparently completely normal in physique. And this was, just on the most superficial level, an obvious opportunity to take that reversal of standards and to show this child, who looks normal to the rest of us and would be perfectly acceptable in the average grade school and not cause any but the most pleasant reactions, is viewed by the Banuskis as a terrible failure. And I needed to reverse that standard, and I needed Chick and his normal physique to emphasize the fact that the standards within this family are based on their attractions for the sideshow. But in order to make him interesting to me, I gave him the power of telekinesis, the ability to move things with his mind, so that there would be yet that other element of great power that could play its role in the plot.
Geek Love is your third novel, and this book is published by Knopf. And they've really invested, I think, a lot of money in advertising the book and promoting it. And I'm wondering if you're feeling at all pressured by that, that you have to live up to everything that's been invested in the book.
Well, it's kind of strange. The book was so much a part of my life for so long that when I finished it, I really grieved. I felt as though I had lost this family. I'd lost this whole world that I'd created, but that had become very real to me. And by the time the book was actually published, I had gone through that kind of long separation process in which editing takes place and planning takes place. And Knopf had been very, very good to me, I have to say. They're really nice people to work with. But by the time the book comes out, I really feel as though it's so disassociated from me that, in a way, it doesn't concern me. I'm glad if Knopf is pleased with the fact that they're into their third printing now, 6 weeks after the book came out. And of course I'm delighted that it's doing well. But in a way, you know what I mean, Terry? It's not personal. It doesn't seem to affect me.
In addition to writing novels, you also write about boxing for the Associated Press. How did you start writing about boxing?
I began writing about boxing in late 1980. When I went to my first live boxing match, or soon after that, I had always been a kind of boxing fan in a lighthearted way because in my family, boxing was just one of the sports that we all enjoyed. But I had never been to a live match until 1980, and I was so stunned by the difference in this live performance from the kind of hygienic and anesthetic versions that you get over television that I was really swept away, and I looked to the newspaper the following day to find out what the reporters thought that they had seen, and of course there was almost no coverage whatsoever, and that really stunned me. So I went to the local alternative newspaper here, Willamette Week, and offered to write regular boxing coverage for them. It was one of those things where I decided that if I was a writer and I wanted this written about, I would have to write it.
Was it ever hard for you to get access to boxers or to break in as a boxing correspondent? It's such a male world.
No, actually, it's a tremendous advantage to be a female in this exclusively male world. Because commonly, even though boxing people, and I'm going to make a terrible generalization here, tend to come from fairly uneducated backgrounds and tend to be pretty chauvinistic in some ways, their basic tenet and the whole premise of their lives is their obsession with this wonderful, bizarre, and terrible sport. If you could box, they wouldn't care if you were a baboon. And if you are willing to write about boxing and are willing to do your homework, they don't really care. They forget all about it. There's that little glitch when a boxing person first realizes that he's talking boxing with a woman. And then it's just a little momentary hitch in the conversation. And then he forgets because all he's really interested in is the sport.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much, Terry. It's really been a pleasure.